Blog Talk Radio.
So quick, can anybody tell me how much 4.4 million tax dollars divided amongst 120 people targeted for quote-unquote assessment and treatment equals? If anybody wants to call in with that kind of information, that would be fabulous. Welcome to Talk with Tenny. I am piloting this out and hoping that somebody is going to call me. Otherwise, I'm just going to keep on talking. I figured the best way to go about doing that was using my Facebook page and looking at some things that are going on in the current world of state-sponsored, organized psychiatric industries. So these are the actual public service delivery systems that are providing psychiatric practices, procedures, and products to citizens. And specifically, I'm looking at America, but this very much is a worldwide issue of how it is that psychiatric services get delivered. So I'm looking at this article that was published in the LA Times by Jill Cowan and Paloma Esquivel. And it's titled OC, First Large County and State to Adopt Laura's Law. And so Laura's Law is a law like Kendra's Law in New York State, which is essentially a euphemism for involuntary outpatient torture and people being stalked by the psychiatric industry based on often fraudulent claims of a disease which doesn't necessarily exist. Anybody want to call and talk to me? Oh, look at this. There's a call. Hello? I'm 718. Hello? Hello? Celia?
Yes.
Hi, Celia. How are you? Good. I was talking to myself.
Right oh, but minute. I didn't press one to call in. I just, you know, just listening.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Good. Is there something you'd like to talk with me about?
Yeah, I would like your thoughts on what you think about the Murphy's Bill. There's so much stuff going on in the companion bill. What are your thoughts?
The H.R. 3717,
right.
Helping Families and Mental Health Crisis Act, House Resolution 3717, quote-unquote, to reform the nation's broken mental health system. It's in an article by Richard Diamond that Buchanan proposes the bill to overhaul the U.S. mental health system. And so the Murphy bill is deeply problematic. I think that this will destroy any hope for people and for humanity to be able to thrive. I think that this is going to be entirely damaging, and it's going to set back any small steps that have been made along the last 50 years. And certainly the last 30 years.
Yeah. What do you think is our defense as a movement? Well, what can we do?
What can we do? We can speak out. we can speak out. And, you know, I had a real fabulous opportunity to talk to so many people who were fundamental in starting the human rights movement of the 1970s of survivors of psychiatric assault and people
wow.
who really began this human rights movement, you know, through DeVoiced. And what I learned from people is that there was a point in time when the mental patients liberation movement was taken seriously, and that it was a legitimate movement like all of the other liberation movements, the Black Power movement, the women's movement,
right.
the LGBT movement, all of these other movements, civil rights movement, obviously. These were all, and it was just, you know, in Ted Chepuzinski's words, we were just one
yeah.
more liberation movement that was taken seriously. And so I think that people, you know, and then I also feel, and I'm going to just say this, I also feel that we have to work. There are many of us, many people who are working on the inside, and those people need support from the outside, or noise anyway. Maybe it may not always seem like support, but that we need to be further than people on the inside can be, because the people on the inside are never going to be able to be further out. And so we have to get to the general public, and I think that's something that everybody agrees about, that the only messages that are getting out to the media are messages about their side, about the fraud, the absolute fraud that psychiatry has something to offer. And with informed consent, people should be able to do whatever drugs they want to do. But the idea that psychiatry has the answers to what our society is currently going through is ludicrous. And the expansion of who is going to be reached by psychiatry now, people don't realize that under the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, it's mandatory. It's going to be, mental health screenings are going to be mandatory. And so it's no longer this little subset of a group that winds up getting targeted. Everybody is at risk. And we need to get to the public to let people know about the fraud of it. You know, there's research that shows like 50% of Americans believe that, you know, psychiatric labels are biologically rooted. But there's no evidence of that. So why does 50% of the population think this? Why is it, you know, why are they allowed to, you know, in the same breath say, you know, that we, you know, this is a biological thing, and we, you know, we have no evidence for it, and it's still accepted. Like, how do you convince society to understand the huge profit that is going on here? When, you know, when I opened, the very first thing I said, and if anybody's got this answer and wants to call in and let me know, what is 4.4 million tax dollars divided among 120 people targeted for assessment and treatment? Who are we supporting here? Because it looks like we're supporting the psychiatric industry, and that this is like a jobs initiative where, you know, and I've said this before, where they hold us in slavery, where our life and liberty is under the control of you know, the master, the psychiatrist. And if you step out of line, I'm going to electroshock you or drug you or tie you to a bed or lock you in a room or prevent you from ever living outside in a community like the creative, you know, wonderful person that you are.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how we get society to understand that. But to me, 120 people having $4.4 million specifically for their assessment and treatment seems like a lot of money for four psychiatric practices and procedures through state-sponsored systems that would then be in direct violation of the United Nations Convention Against Torture. Like, I feel like this is a major, you know, the states are not only not complying with the Convention Against Torture, but they're actively moving toward further breaking it. And then hooking in financial incentives to the states, that the federal government is hooking in financial incentives to the states to create involuntary outpatient laws. And for anybody who's listening who doesn't realize what this means that, you know, if you've been, and I think they're looser than this nationally, but New York's, if you've been institutionalized twice in the last 3 years or considered a danger to yourself or somebody else in the last 4 years, and your neighbor, your friend, your partner, you know, your boss, the county commissioner, whoever, decides that, like, you want to decides that you aren't taking your medication, they can bring you in for 72 hours, and minimally, and evaluate you, and if they choose to keep you. And that's a real multiple human rights violations. And they have no biological evidence of there being any need for any of this. And even if they did, it's still been considered an act of torture by the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Convention Against Torture. So what do we do? And I don't know what we do. So, this article from the LA Times, that's where it states that the proposal before the supervisor calls for allocating about $4.4 million per year in Mental Health Services Act funds to provide an assessment and treatment for an estimated 120 people. Additional funds will need to be allocated for legal and other costs associated with the program. So it's not even $4.4 million. And these are really huge issues that we must address. I have a caller from 443 area code.
You do? How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, my name's Kevin Long. I believe we've met before.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing?
I'm doing well. I want to call in and contribute to your cause and your program.
Thanks. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I would like to talk about the unfair treatment of people in psychiatric situations. I'd like to talk about particularly what happened with me.
Well, what happened with you?
Well, for a long time, I was diagnosed, it was 6 years, with bipolar disorder. After talking to some of the best psychologists and psychiatrists, it turned out that wasn't the case. But it was 6 years of my life I lost.
That's a long time.
It is a long time. And since then, I got my life in better shape because of the psychological cocktails that were given to me. Certainly disrupted my life. And I had 9 promotions in 3 years. I got a full scholarship to a JD, that's a Juris Doctor for Law School, MPH program. And I worked for the President of the United States. And
that's awesome.
And it is awesome. But recently, I got sick. And it's from my smoking, I'm not going to lie. And I had physical symptoms. But they still went back to my old record from the psychological decision that was made 7 years prior. And it affected my treatment. They wanted to do a psychological evaluation as opposed to a physical evaluation.
That's
and
awful.
I wanted to call in about that today.
That's awful. This is why, I mean, I don't mean to say this to upset you, but this is why we're dying 25 to 30 years sooner than anybody else. This is the exact, because if you come in with some kind of medical complaint, automatically they, no matter how far accomplished you are, no matter what it is you've done, if you hold it as a card, when it gets too hot, you pull it out, they usually maybe let you go. But it's, this is why we're dying, because they don't take our medical issues seriously.
And they don't. And one of the things, when I was in law school, I studied was civil rights, and I'm a huge advocate for LGBT rights, and I'm a huge advocate for racial rights, but it was only as a mechanism to get to mental health rights. And I was the founder of the Mental Health Law Club with the president of the APA, not the bad APA, the American Psychological Association, not the Psychiatry Association, and we were able to make some headway in disputing facts that psychiatric medications are the best ways of treating people.
That's great. It's hard to make headway. It's really hard. And so, how did you do it? When you say you made headway, how did you make headway?
So what we did, we had a lot of seminars, and we educated the community. Our community was fairly small. We had about 450 students at our school, but we had a lot of people come in and listen. And I mean, if it's 450 students, if it's 4,500 students, it's great, or people. But that's how we eventually started to get other people to think about this cause. But it's a small voice at the moment. It needs to be a larger voice.
It certainly does need to be a larger voice. And what I'm most afraid of is that by the time this starts to really get to every person in the world, and certainly in America, that it's going to be too late and that the machine is going to just roll us all over. It's really, I mean, and then the human, you know, the both the physical, actual distress from being ill and having that go unrecognized, coupled with the idea of the further dehumanization and discrimination against us because of some fraudulent label, it more than withers. It's like what Bill Cross in Black Liberation Psychology would call the blunting, just totally killing our spirit.
Well, I agree and I disagree with half of that. I think that, yes, it is killing a number of people, but I don't think it's systemic just to America. I think it's more systemic to other countries.
I'm sorry. I agree with that. Go ahead.
Eugenics has just been removed from a few countries and still being participated in African countries. So I think we need to look at it globally, but we also need to look at it in an insular fashion for correcting the healthcare system in the United States.
Well, I agree with you. I agree with you there. And there are plenty of people who are doing work at international levels, World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry, Center for Human Rights of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry, whole other groups. And so, yeah, my focus definitely, I sometimes say it's maybe too American of me to have an American focus.
Student population. You start small and you try to make it bigger.
Yeah.
And you're
no doubt. But I would say that, you know, while we may not actively be calling what we're doing eugenics, it's only in the last 30 years that they've stopped sterilizing us overtly. But there are means of preventing reproduction that are happening through the drugs, like loss of libido, inability to orgasm, those kinds of things, that are having that same kind of effect on some level. And, and then different drugs that have been associated with, like, polycystic ovarian disease and things like that. While they may not actively, at every angle, they attempt to prevent us from reproducing. And so,
well, it's not necessarily reproduction. It's a matter of genocidal enablement. And I mean, eugenics, if you go back to the Nietzschean definition, is to destroying populations, not just destroying the paternal aspect. And I don't think they do that here in America anymore. I think it stopped in the 1970s, if I remember correctly. But, I mean, that's still something that happens in African countries, and
certainly
everything else would be speculation.
Well, speculation maybe, but still things that people don't ordinarily make connections to, especially when looking at, like, one of the main things that, you know, people have issue with the drugs on top of all of, like, the life-disabling, you know, kidney damage, liver damage, like, you know, tardive dyskinesia, neuroleptic malignant syndrome, metabolic syndrome. Like, but besides all of that, one of the big issues that people have of the side effects is that it creates an incompetence in one's sexuality. And so it acts as a suppressant. And so that's subtle. And it's, you know, a quote-unquote side effect, but, you know, being quote-unquote happy from taking an antidepressant is also a quote-unquote side effect. You know what I mean? It's just a positive effect or a negative effect. It's still an effect. And I think that, I don't know, to me, part of solving the problem is getting people to realize that just because these pharmaceuticals are sanctioned and legal doesn't necessarily make them good and safe and effective. Do you know what I mean?
I think that's a very good point, and I would definitely agree with that. I think that the cost-benefit analysis of most of the psychotropics or the SSRIs is counterbalanced by the evidence, and it's facilitated by a different cost benefit, not a physical or mental health analysis. It's actually a monetary analysis. Sound right?
Well, I think the monetary analysis is urgent, and I got a message that it's the 120 people for the $4.4 million would equate to It's 36,666,666.
Yeah, 4.4 billion, right?
$4.4 million.
Okay.
So it's got to be $36,666 and or something like that. But interesting. I math is just not my thing. What are you going to do? The windfall profit is ridiculous. In the article that came out in the Brandenton Herald about Buchanan proposing the bill, what does that say, to overhaul U.S. mental health system, that he's one of the co-sponsors of the Murphy bill that Celia asked about before, the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act, the reform the nation's broken mental health system. So in there, they're saying that it's the government spends $125 billion annually on mental health programs. And so this is a huge industry in which we're fueling here.
Well, and I think the fueling process is interesting when you weigh it against the product liability cases. So in 2010, 9 of the 10 largest product liability cases, and that's meaning in civil cases, 9 of the 10 were actually pharmaceutical companies that were charged. And you look at a company like Forest Laboratories, and they killed 53 kids, and it's because they were ignoring the black box warning label against FDA-regulated drugs. by false marketing. And they take a look at it and they say, well, we can sell all these drugs. And a few kids come in and they pass away. We can just pay out the rest. And that's kind of what they do. It's probably beyond the scope of our argument, but it's the Ford Pinto model. You ever hear of that case?
Of what?
The Ford Pinto case.
No, what's that?
All right, so this is a case where, and it's similar to the GM case, I guess, going on right now.
Okay.
The Ford Pinto, they had a little fix that they had to do on their gas tank, because if you got rear-ended, even at 5 miles an hour, the car would explode. It's a famous first-year law school case, and it killed a lot of people. But they said it was easier to pay off the people that passed away than actually fix the problem. And so I think it was GM. It was probably 2 weeks back in the papers, where they had a 50-cent fix on a starter or something. I don't know a lot about cars. If you don't know a lot about money, I don't know a lot about cars. But it was a starter, and it was a 50-cent fix, but they realized that in terms of product liability, these people could lose their lives, but they would pay out less to the insurance companies, to the lawsuits, than getting the benefit. And that's why potentially see pharmaceutical companies doing now.
Pharmaceutical companies doing what? Sorry, lost you there.
Oh, that's horrible. You're not allowed to lose me. Potentially doing a monetary case-benefit analysis, meaning that, yeah, we're going to dole out all these drugs. We're going to get a lot of money for that. Some people are going to lose their lives, but the amount of money that people spend on these drugs will essentially still give us more money, even though we're paying off these lawsuits or insurance claims.
Well, that... Yeah. So, what do you do to change it?
Well, I think it has to be increased legislation. That's what I truly believe. I think we need better modifications.
More legislation?
I said more legislation.
More legislation? No more.
Why
legislation.
Do you disagree with that?
So if there was more, what kind of legislation if there was more?
Okay, so I think maybe not lobby-induced legislation, but better legislation on the FDA.
I like that phrase, lobby-induced legislation. Okay, so go. So give me your ideas.
So I think we have to have politicians look more into, and this is assuming they're the right politicians based on a demos as opposed to a plutocracy, and that the legislation should be focused on helping the people and protecting them, as opposed to looking at, again, going to the monetary. Why do you disagree with that? That's interesting to me.
Inherently, I don't disagree with what you've said, because I think that ultimately capitalism is the problem. Or at least the greed of it all, if not necessarily the idea that people can, you know, make their own way and have utility and have things to offer others that should be, you know, usable. Without getting into that whole conversation, but the idea that because any legislation that comes out, regardless of which party people are in, they all still are, you know, sold on this idea that psychiatry has something to offer. And so until, you know, and that it has so much to offer that it should be forced on people, and that human rights violations shouldn't apply to people in the name of psychiatry.
Okay, I got
so, you. So whichever side you're on, you never get across to people, because either people think that it's a matter of, like, you know, control, like outright control and, you know, social control and things like that, or they have this, like, you know, idea of, like, this veil of benevolence that, you know, oh, you
okay,
poor thing,
so
you're doing this for your own good.
When
so,
in actuality, it's malevolence, not benevolence. And
Yeah, exactly.
So, it's a proper dissemination of the information pertaining to the diseases as opposed to that of the information that's been perpetuated over the period of 60 years. And I think that makes a difference, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, but, you know, like, it's bogus because, you know, when you look back to, like, the articles of the 1940s, when they were, like, determining the characteristics of childhood schizophrenia, for example. Loretta Bender is the psychiatrist who did this. And so in the definition of childhood schizophrenia, it was either, like, it used words like, quote-unquote, puny or, quote-unquote, retarded or, you know, slow or you know, like, things like that. Or were exceptionally brilliant, had an extraordinary vocabulary, caused transfer and counter-transference in adults. And either of these two ends of childhood experiences were called childhood schizophrenia, and the treatment for them were electroshock, ECT, electroconvulsive treatments, and drugs. And so they were
primitive drugs at that time. I mean, that was primarily lithium treatment, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and nothing. And then in the 60s, it was also LSD that they were being given, and UNM 490, I think. So, you know, which, you know, for an adult, I mean, absolutely. I think, like, people like Timothy Leary, you know, get kicked out of the field because they have something to offer and, you know, are seen as, you know, unreputable or whatever, yet they're giving, like, children in the same government-funded studies, you know, from the same pot of money, they're giving children LSD every day, like two-year-old LSD every day. So,
yeah, and
you know,
then you look at cases, even in 2000, where they're giving kids psychotropic drugs, and this is a study in Mass General, and the brain hasn't fully developed enough to actually run the amorphous course of what the brain will do, yet they're treating them, or so-called treating them.
Absolutely. I just want to cut in for a second and just let people know, if you're listening, the number to call in is area code 267-521-0167. It's area code 267-521-0167. What are your thoughts about all of this? And so, yeah, the drugging of children in this and other countries. And then you add into the mix, like, children who are in foster care. You know, one of my new, like, research endeavors is what is the rate of child experimentation of children who are in foster care, because when the state is your quote-unquote parent, how quick are they to currently be giving children away to be experimented on? It's, you know, something that, you know, and then all of these drugs, I mean, first of all, if you're using them on children, the majority of them are off-label, so there's no evidence of efficacy or safety. And if not, all the other ones have, you know, risk of, you know, heart attack or, you know, other kinds of physical resulting, and it's just, it's terrible.
Well, it certainly is. It's not dissimilar to other trials we've done on minorities, and minorities do include the youth, and it's something that we continue to do with psychiatric medication, as opposed to using proven methods.
Right, for things that, but the, for things that aren't even proving to be existing in any way. You know, there's no, the solutions or behavior modification, for example, the aversives or other things like that, for things that don't necessarily exist. And that is part of the problem. I mean, in this article about, you know, Buchanan co-sponsoring the H.R. 3717, it says, you know, when we deinstitutionalize, this is a quote, when we deinstitutionalized in this country, we let loose a group of people not equipped to live with other people. There was a ruckus about putting people away. It was said, how can we treat people like this? As a result, we closed down all the institutions and threw the patients in the streets. Perhaps a middle ground between closing them all and leaving them all open should be have been found, but wasn't. And, you know, this idea that we let loose a group of people not equipped to live with other people. Like, where the discrimination against us comes from, what allows people to have good conscience about doing what gets done to us, is this exact thing that we're seeing as something that has to, we let loose a group of people not equipped to live with other people. You have any thoughts about that?
I do. I mean, this week I was frightened that, God, I came in for an echocardiogram and an endoscopy, and I was told that, well, you have a history of problems. I go, well, that was proved false. And subsequently, you know, over the years, I've worked with many people that had a lot of problems, and they've done amazing things.
I've worked
with doctors. I've worked with lawyers. I've worked... God, if the president can trust me and I can go through a Secret Service exam, I'm pretty sure that maybe they made a mistake. But it's a stigmatism that is brought on by just an inadequate understanding of the human mind. And you and I don't know the answer to the human mind. I can tell you that. But what I can tell you... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, but nobody does. So go ahead.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That's why I know you and I don't know. But I know that there are better ways to treat it. And for me, I got a little depressed this year. I lost a job, but, get another job. And the best answer for me was talking to friends. And formerly, if I were to go to a doctor, they'd give me medicine. And I don't get that.
Right. I got some other people here I'm trying to call in. Area code 510, are you there?
Go talk to them.
Hello?
That's me. Yeah, 510, I don't know what, 703-6372, that what you have, Lauren?
Yep, you're on the air. Hey, Ted, and area code 613, you're on also?
Hello, I'm trying to get through, I don't know.
Hi, yep, you're on air. So, Ted, you know, just give us a second, let me get to Ted and say hi, and then whoever 613 is, if you'll introduce yourself. Kevin, you still there?
I'm still here.
Great. Okay.
613 is me. Sue Clark Wittenberg is here, 613 from Ottawa.
Hello, Sue. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Lauren. And how are you?
I'm good, thanks. And Ted?
Hi, Lauren. Congratulations on everything here, your radio program, your PhD, and your great political work.
Well, thank you, and thanks for calling in. So... Oh, I was just going to say, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I missed most of your program because I was feeling a little sick, but I did hear you talk about foster kids being experimented on. I was one of those children a long time ago, as you know. And I think, you know, if your listeners, well, I think you probably already made the point that there's just every foster children are routinely drugged, for one thing. You become a foster child. And this phrase, foster child, is very misleading, too, because very few of kids that are taken away from their parents wind up in foster homes. They wind up in institutions, but they keep calling it the foster care system. But anyway, when I was 6 years old, my story is pretty well known, and maybe not to your listeners, I was a ward of the state. I was actually a foster child. I was in a real foster home, and the social worker was saying that I was schizophrenic because my mom had that label, and they just took me to Bellevue Hospital in New York and gave me a course of 20 shock treatments, and then they dumped me into a state hospital for the rest of my childhood. So I know what psychiatry is really about. There's not that much different now. I mean, it really isn't that much different now. I don't know if you discussed the case of Justina Pelletier, who was taken away from her parents because the psychiatrist at Boston Children's Hospital didn't like the kid's diagnosis of some rare metabolic disease. And the psychiatrists get their way, especially if they're from Harvard, which they were. And I do think there's going to be a campaign. There's already the Justina campaign is huge. There must be 100,000 people involved in it. And I think the state's finally caving in. But basically the psychiatrist said, the parents are abusing her because we don't believe in this diagnosis. And therefore when I say it, I realize how bizarre it sounds. But basically the psychiatrist jumped in, said she had somatoform disorder, which is the new name for psychosomatic illness. And there she is. She was ice skating when she was 14, just before she was, you know, taken away by the psychiatrist, and now she goes around in a wheelchair. I mean, and this is not uncommon. There's been a whole bunch of cases like this in the Boston area because, as you can imagine, Harvard psychiatry has huge amounts of power in Boston. But they have power everywhere. That's what happened to me. I used to be an advocate, still am to some extent, used to be an advocate in Northern California here, and I just see one kid after another, they're all drugged. You know, they mostly wind up in these psych wards for suicide attempts. Now, think about that. Why should one child after another be attempting suicide when they're 12, 13, 14 years old? One kid said to me, I still remember this kid because he was 17. He really reminded of me. And he said, all I did was go around threatening to commit suicide. The other kids, some of them actually tried to commit suicide. Why did they send me here? What does that tell you about what's going on in these places? And yet, the way they protect themselves is they, well, we're taking care of the children. If you criticize us, you're just taking away help from these poor children. Well, they're not being helped. It's like these predatory priests who rape altar boys, and what are they going to say? That we're helping them, we're tending to their spiritual needs, or some garbage like that? I mean, what's done to kids in the psychiatric system is just outrageous, and it sickens me that it's so similar to what I underwent, and this is like 70 years ago. More than 70 years ago I underwent this, and it's still happening today. Nothing changes. So I've talked long enough here. thanks again for this program, Lauren, and if you have any questions you want to throw at me to comment on, I'd be glad to say more.
I do. I want to get Sue in for a minute, but if you're willing to hang in on the line for a bit,
certainly.
Great.
Yep,
great.
Sure.
Sue, you still there?
Yes, I am, Lauren,
yeah.
And I want to say to you, I'm very proud of you because you got your PhD.
I'm here.
And
you hear me?
Anyhow, that you are running a very good movement, and I'm so proud of you, Lauren. Okay,
thanks.
You are quite
Let
an achiever,
just...
and I think you have a great passion and spirit for fighting psychiatric oppression and torture. I just want to say a little bit here on the radio, okay, that I'm the director of the International Campaign to Ban Electroshock. I had the ECT in 1973 at the Brockville Psychiatric Hospital. I was forced to have shock. And I'll tell you, okay, that on my fifth electroshock, my heart stopped. And now I suffer from severe memory problems and learning problems, okay, that I didn't have before. And anyhow, okay, our group, called ICBE, deems electroshock to be unethical, torture, barbaric, it's inhumane, and a crime against humanity. And anyhow, they don't tell the public, okay, the psychiatrist, okay, that it can kill you while having it. It can cause a heart attack, that it always causes brain damage. And so I want to say also, Lauren, that 100,000 people are getting electroshock, and a lot of them are having forced electroshock. I believe that electroshock should be banned, okay, in all countries. It should be banned, okay, like the internationally, because it is a crime against humanity.
I agree with you
100%. Yeah, I'd second that, too.
I think that this is, and I thank you for your work, Sue, and you for your work, Ted, and Kevin, and Celia. Celia, are you still there?
Yes.
Yes, I am, yes.
Hi, Sue.
Hi. You know, what I've been interested in, and I don't know if a lot of people are, is alternative funding. I think that if we're going to be independent, we have to figure out ways to fund some of the things that we're doing. And so, I'm not saying we need to have a long discussion here, but it's just something to think about.
As David Oakes said, remember the activist groups.
Right.
I want to ask Sue, what in particular are you thinking about that needs...
Well, I know a lot of people maybe on this call don't participate in alternatives, but we really need alternatives. And I'm thinking about, you know, when Howie T. Harp and Judy were creating all these alternatives to the system, that I don't really see that anymore. You know, and I'm wondering how we can not get the same thing like what happened in the 70s, but some alternatives. And some of the things I was thinking about, and this is lack of a better term, but like an underground railroad to get people out of outpatient involuntary commitment, which is would take a lot of work to get people out of that. Like I think of Justina, if she could be kidnapped from the hospital into the safety place, I think it would be a good thing, because I don't really know. I think she's already damaged. She's going to continue to be damaged in the hospital, and she needs to get out into healing, into people who really can care about her.
And she needs to be with her family.
Right, her
family, who is so loving and who's only allowed to see her for 30 minutes three times or 20 minutes three times a week, and who have been, you know, had a gag order put on them that they couldn't talk about what was happening to their daughter, and that have been
I have some more recent facts about that, by the way. Since she's been in Connecticut, apparently the place that they put her in is being very cooperative with her parents, and I understand that they actually took her out of the place for an outing a few days ago, and the person that I'm in most touch with, Melissa Cairns, who's kind of a leader of the parents that are involved in this, she, although they've been demonstrating everywhere, every place that they've put Justina, she says, don't demonstrate against this place. So the picture I'm getting is, they're slowly caving, because I mean, there really have been about 100,000 people involved in this campaign, and I think they're starting to cave. But if you don't mind, I want to just raise something very briefly here about an area where nobody's been talking about, which is there's now, what's her name, Monica Cassani, you know, with her blog Beyond Meds, has called, her excellent blog, has called a movement of its own, which is there's a whole bunch of people trying to help themselves now get off psych drugs, and this is not easy. I mean, I had the privilege of being in one of these groups because I have my own, you know, psychiatric abuse to cope with, but it was just heartbreaking to me to hear these people talking about all the terrible things they have to go through to get off these drugs, And I think our movement hasn't been paying too much attention to it. We're certainly not going to get any grants from the psychiatric system to get people off these drugs. But I think this is affecting thousands of people. And I will say that anybody who does this, anybody who has the courage to go through years of this stuff, they really have a lot of courage, a lot of, because they're trying to reclaim who they are. They're trying to get back their authenticity. They're trying to become all they can be rather than drug zombies. And I don't think our movement's dealing with this very much. I don't know what we can do because we need tons of money, as Sue is talking about. But I think there should at least be more discussion about this because I've just been totally, totally really affected by these people. I just find it very poignant to hear all this stuff. And they're such great people because these are not, these are people who really have courage, people who really have determination, and they're really suffering getting off these long-term psych drugs. So I wish we'd address this more.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to say something for a minute. I have to go shortly because I have someone that's going to do my wash because I have two broken shoulders here. Anyhow, just to let you know, okay, that I had taken psychiatric pills from 1972 to 1990, and I was on 13, like, the different types of pills during those 18 years.
Oh, my God.
And
oh
I
God.
Had 15 psychiatric diagnoses. It's all bogus. I believe that psychiatry is a fraud, I think, as we all know, and that I got off the pills by myself because I called some of the drug, the rehab houses. They said, if you're a psychiatric patient, we can't help you about your psychiatric drugs. I went cold turkey, and that's the worst thing to do. But since 1990, I've been drug-free, hospital-free, and I fired my shrink. So I've been free of psychiatry now for 24 years. And just to let you know, wow, that electric shock always causes brain damage. According to Dr. Bragan, and a lot of others have reported, that it does cause brain damage, and there's no test, no proof that the mental illness exists. There's no proof. It's all bogus. But anyhow, it was good talking to you, Lauren. I have to wait for someone to bring up my wash. But you're all wonderful people, wonderful activists, and it was good talking to you from Canada, eh? I always say eh.
Thanks, Sue. Before you go, would you tell everybody your website address, please?
Yes, I will. Okay, my facebook.com/SUECLARK Wittenberg, WITTENBERG. And that's a tongue twister, eh?
Okay, I will make sure that it gets up.
And I want to thank, I want to thank you all for chatting with Lauren. And I think you have an excellent show. And I think you're fabulous, all of you. Bye.
Thanks, Sue. Bye.
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 We also have somebody on the line from area code 315.
That could be me. This is George Ebert.
Hey, George.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm best ever and getting better every day. Hey. So
George.
Hey. So I was hoping, Lauren, you'd mention Bastille Day is coming up.
Oh, yeah.
Bastille Day is coming up, and we would love as many people as who would want to be able to come. It's my understanding it's going to be from July 13th at 6 p.m. to July 16th at 6 p.m. on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health. And
is that
we will
Albany?
Be. That is in Albany, New York. There is a Facebook event page for Bastille Days 2014, and we will be celebrating the human spirit and speaking out against psychiatric oppression. And, George, is this correct that it's the 34th annual Bastille Day?
That is correct.
Awesome.
Would you give us a little of the history behind that, George?
It's a long history. The Alliance started it in Syracuse, I guess, 34 years ago, and I've been doing it or being involved with it ever since. Lauren, you've been active and involved in and played a significant part in several of them, particularly the one on the calling attention to and getting some policy directive changes on the use of shock treatment on children.
That was an amazing year. That was the year of the fast, right?
Yes.
I still think that we should say that, oh, the fast. George, do you want to talk about it?
It's your show. I was hoping you'd do the talking, but we did.
Okay.
We did. Go ahead.
Well, the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance, the Alliance, held, I think it was 8 days that we fasted in protest of the use of electroshock on children in New York State. And the Office of Mental Health wound up putting out a policy directive which severely limited the ability to use it, but it's still legal to use, and there are still young people who can be used on. So I think that this is a major issue that we always are trying to stop having young people. But it was fabulous. We were on the east lawn of the Capitol for 8 days with tents, and we had all petitions signed, and we turned sheets of petitions, a thousand or 800, I don't remember the number, into the Office of Mental Health, and had gotten a little bit of press coverage that day. Radio station up there, but we still have work to do. We're not, you know, it's not, unfortunately, it's not done. And so part of the 34th annual Bastille Day's celebration and demonstration is going to be about getting involved with the discussion and planning for nonviolent direct public action to expose the need for human rights within psychiatric mental health. And so we're looking for people who want to get involved with planning and promotion. There's a way that organizations or individuals can co-sponsor the event. And organizations that have already signed on their co-sponsoring include the International Campaign to Ban Electroshock, Sue Clark-Wittenberg, who was just on, the Opal Project, Mind Freedom International, and, you know, others coming in. I think I maybe am missing one or two. People should, you know, contact us. The Alliance's 800 phone number, if I'm correct here, George, off the top of my head, is 800-654-7227.
Correct.
Yeah, I think that's a number that everybody should have memorized. especially if you only have one call. So I think that, you know, Bastille Days is a time to recharge and be amongst like-minded people, and it's just a wonderful healing event where, you know, we really try to make some concrete change in the way people are being treated.
All right, and it's not like people need to, it's going to be 72 hours because anyone can be picked up and isolated, detained, isolated, interrogated for 72 hours for an evaluation. The event will be 72 hours. We're not expecting people to stay all that time. There is shared accommodations nearby and reasonable accommodations nearby, too.
I might be there. I may be there. Sounds exciting.
Really,
I've never been to one, George. What? I'm planning a trip to the Northeast. We should talk about it privately. I want to talk to you about this, Lauren. And you, George.
Okay.
So.
Sounds like a plan. So Bastille Day is coming up, and the American Psychiatric Association protest that was coordinated through Mind Freedom International and the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights just occurred on May 4th. And so we're really in the swing of trying to get people active again. And I think what Celia brought up before about independent funding, it's really, I think, where we need to be going, and that the state is not going to support us working against it. And so we need to find avenues that people can do what it is that, you know, speak out the truth. And so I was just wondering, did anybody else have any ideas about that? Or Celia, did you want to follow up on any of that?
No,
go ahead.
There is a book called The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, which talks about, you know, how, in fact, not our groups, it's all true all over the left, you know, everybody's given a bunch of money to shut them up, and then people don't do anything. So the people who didn't want to do that have come up with some ways to deal with this that I think addresses what Celia is talking about. The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, it's called. If you get it, you can just read the first 50 pages, which has the best stuff in it, and it gives you quite a lot of ideas. The main thing is we don't need to have, like, conferences that cost $100,000 to put on, and we don't have to have fancy offices or high salaries and stuff like that. Not only do we don't need to have them, but we can't have them if you want to really do anything. But anyway, The Revolution Will Not Be Funded. Look for it. It was a very valuable book.
Okay, it's a book?
Yeah, it's a book. It's like an anthology. Some of the articles aren't too great, but the introduction is quite long, and if you dip into the rest of the book, you'll see certain places where they said, we don't want to take this money, then we can't do anything. So they found ways to self-fund, basically. Now, that's okay for a political group. I think for the kind of alternatives, you're going to need more stable funding, but at least...
Right.
We're not going to get money for alternatives until we have a real movement like we used to have 30 years ago, you know. But I think this book is really valuable. In fact, I got to go take another look at it since I'm kind of reactivating myself.
Well, wait a minute. Let me write it again. I'm a little tired.
The revolution will not
Lauren?
Be funded.
Okay. Thanks.
Yes. Kevin, you have something to...
Yes. Could you give them my information? And this is something I do regularly. And I raise great deals of money. So,
well, I would
yes,
love
I
to
will.
Talk to you. This is Celia.
I will have everybody put in touch. Yes, thank you, Kevin. That's awesome. I want to give out
you.
The phone number again if anybody's listening and wants to call in. We're on for another hour. 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. What do you want to talk about? Okay, so the revolution will not be funded. Right. That's,
I got
that sounds,
it.
Yeah,
it
that sounds like...
It will not be televised either.
No, but revolution
unless you happen to be using video.
This is where I'm going to step in. What can be funded are alternative solutions for individuals, and they can be done through grants. And that's the stuff I know about.
But
the problem
will
with grants...
People talk to me about that offline, and...
Okay, that's fine.
The thing about foundation grants, they have an agenda,
well, it'd be
too.
Weird if I had a foundation. Oh, I do.
Well, I certainly want to hear about that, Kevin. I know we don't have a lot. We shouldn't take up all the time to talk about it, but I can get your number from Lauren, I guess.
Get my number.
Absolutely.
I'll
connect you. But I think what Ted was about to start saying is an important point that we all know, but people who are listening may not be aware of. So, Ted, would you follow that line of thought about the issues with
the
foundations and agendas?
I forget now. Well, the foundations just have their own agenda. I don't think you'll find too many foundations that are much different. I mean, as we know, our movement was kind of taken over by the federal mental health system, but the foundations are mostly not much better. They're all, you know, they'll fund you. They'll set up jobs for whatever it is, peer this or that, teaching former survivors to work, pushing drugs on other people, stuff like that. The money always comes with strings, and basically I think the people that wrote about some successes, they basically just had a self-fund. They had to go out into the community they were working for, and get the money, you know, in $5 or $10 at a time, and just, you don't need any fancy, I mean, if people think they're going to get paychecks of $100,000 a year, as some of these groups that claim to be in our movement get, well, you know, if you're going to get a paycheck for $100,000 a year and your paycheck depends on doing what the system wants you to do, you're going to do what the system wants you to do. So you can't make money off a real social change movement. Social you can't get, there's lots of, what's the word I want, immersion, changing society. It's not that easy to do. You can't just get a grant and say, you're not going to say anything. You're going to do what they give you the grant for. So it takes, I'm glad Celia's bringing this issue up, though. It's very important because we're kind of paralyzed in a way. Those of us that really want to do something and really want to go up against the system are swamped with all the system money that's being given to other people who seem to think that their job is to be public relations.
Yeah, so let me just jump in here for a second. Let me just jump in here in a second, and just to anybody who may be listening, who may, like, you know, be somebody who really believes in what we're talking about here and really sees the damage and harm that psychiatry does and wants to invest in this movement, if there happen to be any, like, you know, rich people listening right now, feel free to get in touch with me and see how we can work together in order to help get this message that isn't fueled by pharmaceutical industries or special interests or, legislation or, you know, that there's organizations that are actively working to do that. And so if you're somebody who isn't really wanting to get out on the street and yell and scream and or go do, protests or go to meetings or community board meetings or any of that, but you want to support these efforts, by all means, contact me, and I will put you in touch with people who really could utilize, independent resources in different ways. And I think that that's an important thing that we need to constantly be letting the general public know, because I think when you look at things like Justina Pelletier and others who are just being sideswiped and having their children napped from them and having psychiatry, destroy families and lives, they may really want to be able to support this effort as protections for human rights. And people should know that this is one way that we can reach out to people about that.
Lauren, can I just mention the conference? And Mind
Please do.
Giving? Okay.
Please
well,
do.
Mind Freedom is sponsoring a conference called Creative Revolution, Developing and Expanding Alternatives. It's going to be at Wisdom House. It's on our website, July 24th to July 27th. Mm-hmm. And we, people are just paying for room and board. So it's not like the other conferences. It's just one fee. It's a beautiful place. So I hope you'd come and be with us.
Tell us more about it.
Tell us more about it and also give the website, please.
It's mindfreedom.org, O-R-G. And it's a conference for people discussing and learning about alternatives and developing, alternatives that are already developed, like Soteria House. They have a couple of people who are going to facilitate, sessions. So it's not going to be workshops. It's going to be everybody having a dialogue about these different things. Mm-hmm. Soteria House. How to have a drug-free center with, withdrawal from psychiatric drugs, peer on respites, and Hearing Voices Network as well. So I hope you will check us out.
How long is it, Celia?
It's July 24th, so it's on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. July 27th.
So July 24th to July 27th in Connecticut, right?
In Litchfield, Connecticut. It's a place called Wisdom House. It's a retreat center.
How far is that from some larger city we can fly to, Sierra?
Hartford maybe. Their closest airport is Bradley, but Hartford probably. Anyway, I'll be putting up, or the Choices Committee that's organizing it will put up, directions on how to get there and everything.
Great. And people can find more information at www.mindfreedom.org.
Yes, it's on our front page. You'll see it.
Great. Fabulous.
Thanks, Lauren.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And thank everybody at Mind Freedom who's working to make it happen. And so I think that, you know, this is part of the issue. So I read this statement before. I would love to get some of your opinions on this, if you don't mind. It's in that article about Buchanan proposing bill to overhaul U.S. mental health system, the co-sponsorship of the Murphy bill, H.R. 3717. He says, when we deinstitutionalized in this country, we let loose a group of people not equipped to live with other people. Any thoughts about that? We let loose a group of people not equipped to live with other people.
Right away he's saying we're subhuman. And I think we should fight this kind of crap head on. This is just bigotry. It's no different from them, you know, calling people niggers or faggots, you know. It's just, or women bitches, or all this, any disadvantaged group has to put up with this, but we seem to be the last one almost, and I think we should just call it what it is. It's pure bigotry, and they're saying that we're not human, we don't deserve, well, that's what we talk about, human rights, and we don't get them because they say we're not human. And at the same time, you know, they say, oh, well, we're here to help you, right? This is all going to be help. People are going to get the help they so desperately need, right? Well, all that's really happening with these bills is drug people more. Now, they present it to people like the NAMI parents, who I think, I actually feel there's a lot of members of NAMI that are well-meaning people, but not in the leadership. But they present it to these people as if they're going to really get help for their family members, and all they're going to get is more of the same drugs they've been getting right along. And that's all it is. It's just another ploy for the drug companies to put as many people on drugs as possible, you know. But the statement you just read, though, is just, we should just tell it like it is.
What?
It's just a pure bigotry.
We let loose a group of people not equipped to live with other people. Celia, what do you think about that?
I'm enraged by that. I read that, and I just think that if they don't see us as human, they can do whatever they want to us, which they've been doing, and I think it's criminal in a lot of ways, you know? And I really don't know how to get the message out that, yes, we're human, we have lives, you know, we don't need to be in the system. I think it's a hard battle for us. We really have to think about and strategize on how to get this message out to the public, like Ted was saying. So I'd like to hear more how we can do that, you know?
Is there some way to hold the media legally accountable for publishing this kind of stuff?
No.
I think we have to build a movement.
That maybe hasn't been discovered yet.
No, it hasn't. And it can't be. And the media has the First Amendment rights, and no, it can't be held accountable.
The thing is, we have to have a movement that's strong enough not to be ignored, and we don't have that right now. And I think we have to look to building our movement, and yeah, we need to get into the media, but one thing that I think we haven't done in a long time, and which I'm not afraid to do, I'm 77 years old, but I'll do it, is we need to have some civil disobedience at some of these facilities. You know, if they're doing shocking children, if 20 or 30 or 40 of us get arrested for sitting in the doorway, that's going to get into the media. I mean, when Mind Freedom had its fast, some years back, that got into the media. They got a great story in the Washington Post, which I should say also has from time to time given us a good shape. So, but we got to do some, look, the civil rights movements, you know, the current version of the civil rights movement or the version of the 1960s, because black people have really been struggling for 400 years for their rights, but what started in the 60s was started by four students who sat in at a lunch pad and wouldn't leave. Four students. And then they were joined by more and more people, and in a few months this was a huge movement, and still is, but it's because people were willing to make sacrifices and take risks and do things that people would pay attention to. And we can do that, too. I mean, it's nonsense if we're going to have grants from the mental health system. That's not – you may notice the media never covers that. They don't pay any attention to that nonsense. We need to act like other civil rights movements have done. And myself, it's been my inspiration. I would like to interject
as someone who studied civil rights law. The bottom line is all of those civil rights movements, including them sitting in at a deli counter, including Rosa Parks sitting on the back of the bus, do you know what they were fueled by?
What?
Lawyers. And you have to
I'm
have
a lawyer.
Fun.
I don't have that much faith in lawyers.
Well, they're the ones who fueled Plessy. They fueled Brown versus Board of Education. They're the ones who fueled the 1964 Civil Rights Act. They're the ones who created a differentiation between what needs to be done. And that's the only way in which people can work.
I think the lawyers can be of assistance sometimes, but I also think what Ted is talking about is urgently important. We need to be back in a way of creating a message to society that this is not okay and people are willing to have their own rights compromised to try to get that point across. I agree in some capacities, and I agree in anarchy in that capacity,
but...
Not everybody does, but I think that there is the situation. I think that there are some of us who still believe that peaceful, nonviolent, assembly that if it leads to some act of civil disobedience in order to gain attention for our work is important. And 2014 isn't the 1960s or 70s for sure. And people are more afraid now to come out in those kinds of ways than ever before. Some of that is because people are working in these roles, of this peer industry that prevents them from being able to speak out. And some of it is just because of the general police state which we're living in, where now something like civil disobedience is a felony. And so there are lots of issues with it, but I think that what was successful in looking through, Ted lived it, George lived it, I've read it,
and looking through
what was being done with Madness Network News in the 70s and 80s, and how the movement would, in small local spots, that it really only does take a small group of people to affect a great change if those people are willing to stand up or sit down, for that matter, for their rights and for the rights of all of these people that are currently being abused and tortured by this system. And so for those of us who have escaped it and gotten out, not all of us who have escaped it and gotten out, but for those of us who have escaped it and gotten out and have this drive to call social attention in ways that include activism, that we should. And we should do it often, and we should do it frequently, and we should continually try to get other people interested in doing it with us.
I think there's space for these other things,
but these other things usually wind up, being just lesser evils in some way because of the restraints of the larger systems in which they're operating. And what we need to do is change the blueprints of those systems and how
people... And to change the blueprints, you have to change the laws.
That's a chicken-egg. That's a chicken-egg debate in my mind. And
no,
so I think we can talk about it. I think we can talk. Well, no, because you can't legislate compassion. You can't legislate that people are decent to other people. And those are the kinds of things, the values that need to change in our society. And I think that the work that the liberation movement has done over the years, the Network Against Psychiatric Assault, the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance, Mind Freedom, all of these organizations, more recently Psych Rights, all of these organizations are calling public attention, and I think that it's desperately needed in order to have that, in order to reach the kind of change that we need. And I'm just curious, Ted, you mentioned sit-ins earlier, and so would you talk a little bit about the kinds of things that you were doing in the 70s and 80s?
Well, yeah, we blocked the entrance to the... But I want to backtrack a little bit, though, Lauren, about the role of lawyers. I mean, the Civil Rights Act of... It's not like you had the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and then people... I'm a lawyer, so I don't have great faith that lawyers are going to do it all. The role of lawyers, for one thing, is to get you out of jail when you've sat in. But the role of, but the way you change that, you don't change the law in a vacuum. There has to be a movement behind it first. I mean, when they passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, that was following a huge movement in just 4 years, got that done. It wasn't done because some legislators decided they would do it and people were just wandering around having demonstrations. It was the demonstrations that created the political pressure to create that law. Of course, lawyers have a role to play. I have a role to play as a lawyer. But I think of myself more as an activist than a lawyer, unfortunately, for my bank account. But then the things we did, I mean, one of the things I remember, I wasn't in the San Francisco Bay Area at the time. I think it would have been in 1975. The Network Against Psychiatric, there was a hospital, St. Mary's Hospital, doing a lot of shock treatment in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah.
And the Network Against Psychiatric Assault marched right into the, this is pretty, I don't know if I would have been for it even, they marched right into a Sunday Mass at the St. Mary's Cathedral protesting shock treatment. Because I think if you're a religious person, you do have to do what's moral and ethical. You can't just say, oh, I'm religious, but I don't have to pay any attention to the reality of things. Another thing we did is... We blocked the entrance to the American Psychiatric Association's annual meeting in 1980. We also, after Berkeley, we blocked the entrance to Herrick Hospital, the main shock place in Berkeley, in 1983. I was arrested in that. But it's been done a lot. There have been other demonstrations, too, which I don't remember at the time. And I must say also, for those who say, oh, my God, it's so scary, we're all going to get our heads beat in. I have to tell people, I've been in this movement for over 40 years, and we've never, ever once had any problem with the police. And I'll tell you something, the cops are mostly on our side. They really are.
Absolutely.
I remember we had this demonstration at this hospital in Richmond, California, about 20 miles from San Francisco, 8 miles from Berkeley. And the cops were so, and we got it closed too eventually, and the cops were so much on our side, man. All you got to do is tell them ahead of time what you're going to do and just cooperate with them, don't block the sidewalk or whatever. And most kickers, cops are working people, I mean, there's some sadists there, but mostly they're just working people. They have a job to do. And they see what these places do. They know that these places are just hell. They have to take people to these places, and they see what's going on in these places. So I don't think anybody needs to worry. We've had sit-ins. When we did the sit-in, sorry.
No, I would just second that and say that every time that we've ever done it for any of the Esmond Green vigils, for the APA protest, for the Bastille days, we always have the police understand where we're coming from when we're trying to. It's never been an issue. I've been doing this for 20-something years. I've never been arrested. And I don't want to speak on behalf of others, but the things that people have gotten arrested over are ludicrous and did not absolutely in any way deserve, at different places and times, didn't deserve being arrested. And so I think that, you know, the message that we're always having a peaceful, nonviolent protest, and that they're very often with permits, is important to let people know that. So I agree with you. Sorry to interrupt you, Ted.
The only time that any of us got arrested, as far as I know, is we were planning to be arrested at the Berkeley demonstration. We told the cops what we were going to do. We assured them it wasn't an anti-police demonstration. And what they did is they let us block the entrance long enough for the reporters to talk to us and the TV cameras to film it and all that. And then they came in and led us by the arm to the paddy wagon, and nobody was fighting with the cops, and the cops weren't fighting with us. And, you know, and they basically cooperated in letting us make our point, because they could have just rushed in and yanked us away from the door, you know. But we cooperated with them, you know. It's just their job, you know. And I think this is important, because a lot of people are afraid to do this. And I can tell you that unless you want to fight with the cops are not going to fight with you. They're basically, more or less, most of them on our side. I've never had any problem with the cops, and I've been in dozens of demonstrations over the years.
And I'll completely agree with you on the demonstration aspect, but it has to be coordinated. And I think that you're a lawyer, right, Tim?
Yeah, Ted, yeah.
All right. So, Plessy, what did they do there?
Who? Where?
Plessy.
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. 1896. Plessy, that was the separate but equal case. I don't know
the great details.
And Brown versus Board of Education ruled that
1954.
Basically, the ruling was separate is inherently unequal.
Yeah.
My child psychology teacher, Kenneth Clark at City College, is one of the psychologists who testified about how these kids felt when they were forced to be in these inferior schools, which weren't equal anyway, of course.
Oh, that's really cool.
That was a big...
All right. To get to the point, what did they do with Plessy? His inherent... but his construction of being black was based on him being 1/8 black, but he looked white. Is that correct?
I don't know the details of that case. I only know that it established the doctrine of separate but equal is okay. And the Brown versus Board of Education case established the principle that separate is not equal and isn't okay.
All right. Then we'll move to Rosa Parks. So, Rosa Parks.
Rosa Parks didn't establish any legal precedent. She just put her body on the line and inspired people. This is what you have to do with your own Rosa Parks. Because she had a great commitment to her cause. She was a very brave woman.
But who was it predicated on? Was it her cause?
I didn't understand your question.
African-American stance. But
she was a black person who was ready to fight for her freedom, and she did that, and the effect that she had was to inspire other people to also fight for their freedom, and that's what we need to do. We have to be like Rosa Parks. We have to be like the kids who sat in the lunch counters.
I think that's part of where we really need to inspire people to get back to our roots. And get back to the idea that this is a liberation movement, this isn't a job, and that, you know, if people wind up doing good things and, you know, assisting people and happen to get paid for it, that's fine. But when people are finding themselves in situations of where they're being silenced or retaliated against for speaking out, or that they're afraid to speak out because they're afraid of being retaliated against in terms of losing their position or their access, these are the problems that we need to address. And I think that this is again where we go back to having to...
groups sitting in front of buildings. We need to do legal precedent, and we have to make it a civil rights issue, and we have to establish that equality is the issue.
Right, but Kevin, I think that we need more lawyers like you and Ted and Jim Gottstein.
Are you a lawyer too?
No. No, but I'm just saying.
Is Kevin a lawyer?
Oh, I suffered. No.
Kevin is a lawyer.
I'm not a lawyer. Kevin, I'm sorry. Kevin.
I work in politics.
You're a lawyer. Sorry, Kevin.
You're not a lawyer. I'm sorry.
I went to law school. I'm not a lawyer.
Okay, but anyway, I think we need a pool of lawyers who are willing to fight these civil rights cases, and currently we don't have a lot of them doing it. We have a couple of them to partner with activists. It needs to be a partnership. You know, I agree with Ted earlier that, you know, the liberation movement was really driving this, and lawyers were there, but they can't be the only ones. It has to be, you know.
Oh, no, it has to be massive.
Together.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
And the other part is we have to follow other civil rights movements. We have to follow the African-American movement. We have to follow the LGBTQ movement, which is happening now.
Yes.
And that's all predicated on
the gay movement, yes.
And the thing is that in the 70s, when Ted was doing this and George was doing this in the 70s, we were another liberation movement. And what's happened, unfortunately, is that the movement largely was bought out. And so now there's all kinds of things, and I'm not saying that they're bad things, but there are all kinds of things that are happening, but there's very little that's happening around people being able to stop this from happening. I think, you know, Ted, if I can refer to something you said in Devoiced, paraphrasing it, which I thought was just, you know, really on the money, is that, you know, you're allowed to do advocacy up to a certain part, but advocacy doesn't include changing the psychiatric practices, procedures, or products. And so that's the problem that we're facing. And then people are, you know, some people are getting exposed to the history of the movement and what this, you know, new now licensing procedure for peers is about or whatever. But there's not... there isn't a real knowledge of our history or a connection to why we're doing it. And the people that are getting hired to do these jobs are people that they're targeting as people who are going to be compliant with psychiatry and get other people to be compliant with psychiatry. And I think that if there's ways to reach out to people who are in those positions to, you know, turn their head to the other way and let them see what it was supposed to be about instead of what the government has made it about. And I just have to say, you know, for people who are working at the federal level and the whole Murphy attack on SAMHSA as anti-psychiatry, I've never heard a more ludicrous statement in my entire life than the idea that SAMHSA is anti-psychiatry. SAMHSA is the furthest thing in the world from anti-psychiatry, as is any of the federal organizations or the Alternatives Conference or any. And so, you know, you asked before why, you know, why, Celia, you asked, you know, why aren't people involved? And I'll tell you that, like, in 2008 when I was involved, I wasn't allowed to print the word advocacy in my workshop, and I wasn't allowed to talk about advocacy at the Alternatives Conference. And so I stopped being involved. And so these are issues. And prior to that, I stopped being involved in 2000 or something like that when they started bringing in professionals. It was like 99 or 2000 where the, you know, professionals started presenting at the Alternatives Conference. And so it was a breakdown. And what I've learned from people like Ted and George and others is that in 1985, it had been the International Conference on Psychiatric Oppression and Human Rights. And in 1985, the federal government started paying for it. And not slowly, like immediately, there was a different goal and agenda for people who were participating in this conference, and that they couldn't speak out anymore, and that it became this well-funded machine where now there are people being certified in a new profession. that is based on the idea that people are equal and there's an inherent power in the actual profession. And how do you get somebody who doesn't know anything about any of this to understand the organization of how they are actively, you know, trying to silence the fact that psychiatric practices and procedures and products are life-threatening and that everyone is at risk, and instead they've got, you know, a whole new army of people that they're sending out there saying, no, this is good, you'll like this. And then when people voluntarily go in and then they say, oh, wait, this isn't what I thought I was going to get, and they try to get out, they're then forced into it. It's a self-perpetuating system. And we need people to speak out.
And we have to fight. And I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with Ted. I don't disagree with George. And I disagree with the approach. And I think that there has to be a more directive approach. I think that there has to be a more legally represented approach. And I think that...
Well, I mean, you want to talk about illegally get mental hygiene legal services to stop putting us away and to actually start defending us. Like, there's, you know, it's not even about the legislation. It's about the people who are actively, the lawyers who are actively involved. Somebody said to me the other day, they're like the invisible needle. They're the ones that are, you know, that they're vicious in their benevolence to make sure that we are forcibly treated.
You can also look at lawyers that are really...
I'm sorry.
You can look at lawyers that are really doing their best, like Jim Gottstein, he was involved in organizing the APA demonstration. He's doing, as a lawyer, I can tell you, he's doing great work in Alaska. He's getting all kinds of great precedents from the Alaska Supreme Court. But nonetheless, how much effect can he have? There has to be a movement behind it. I mean, for instance, what Jim is saying is, I forget exactly what it was. He says he's gotten some precedents from the Alaska Supreme Court about, say, involuntary drugging, but on the ground it's ignored because there isn't enough of a movement in Alaska to force them to follow the law. So the state Supreme Court says one thing, and the psychiatric institutions basically thumb their nose at the courts, and we have nobody to enforce it. So you have to have a movement. Lawyers are fine. I mean, I have nothing against lawyers. I am a lawyer. But I'm an activist. I mean, I became a lawyer to sort of work on my activism. Unfortunately, in the middle of doing that, our movement got taken over by the federal mental illness system. We need lawyers, but lawyers aren't the ones that are going to do it. Lawyers come in afterwards.
No,
there's
we're
a movement
not.
Already.
I want to just come in here with the phone number.
I'm going to get off the phone because I'm dominating the discussion, I think.
I think that if you want to stay, Ted, that's good. I just wanted to give the phone number in case anybody wanted to jump in. It's area code 267-521-0167, 267-521-0167. I do think that, on both sides that there are some really valid points. And, of course, the work that people like that Jim Gottstein himself is doing and then people who are doing the type of work that he's doing is really important, and it can make differences. And I agree with what Celia said, that we need to be working in partnerships with people. But in that partnership, what ordinarily winds up happening, and Ted and George, if you're still there, please correct me if I'm wrong, but what ordinarily winds up happening is that the people who are coming from an activist position are immediately silenced or suppressed in order to meet the needs of whatever the profession that we're working alongside with are. And so
and
until...
I think the suppression has to be quelled by legal matters. I think that's the work.
I think Celia's trying to get in for a second.
Yeah, Kevin, I just, you know, I hear you about lawyers, and I do think there's a need to have a group of lawyers that fight, you know, fight for our human rights, but also can educate these other lawyers that don't really stand up for us, and maybe that's something that you may want to work on. So, you know, I'm not against what you're saying. I'm just thinking that we just need to work in partnership, you know?
I think so, too.
Yep.
I think you're 100% right.
Area code 518. Oh, we just lost area code 518. Sorry, go ahead. In and out. Oops, that must have been a slip of the tongue. But I think that where we can come together, that we should come together, but understand that we have different strategies and tactics in order to bring our movement, you know, forward. And I think it's really important. What's that?
I'm not sure. I guess I wasn't on when Celia talked about working in whatever. Could you sort of state your position in a briefly, Celia, because I missed
it. Yeah,
I think
like what Lauren was saying, I think we all could be doing what our passion is. If Kevin wants to work with lawyers, that's fine. If we want to be activists, you know, we are activists and work in the movement, I think that's fine too. But I think we all need to work together. I really don't think that our movement can just not work in partnership with other groups. I think we need that because we'd just be talking to each other.
I mean,
lawyers that agree with our position, like Jim Gottstein and Tina Minkowitz and other people. We haven't even brought in the prison system in this whole conversation. And, I mean, I just think we need to work with outside grassroots organizations and teach them or do consciousness raising about what our issues are so that they can work with us. Cause it's just
I agree
us.
With that.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
I agree with that, and I think we haven't done enough of that, too. I think you're totally right, Sia. We need to go out there and get, but the thing is, you can't just go out there and lecture them. You have to work on their issues, and then they take you seriously, you know.
But I bet you they're going to come. They have family members or they have people they know that's been in the system and been told a lot of things.
There are people themselves that have been in the system in these groups.
Yeah,
remember,
okay.
There's 30 million people in this country that have been, you know, on psych wards as inmates, and there's a lot of them out there. I'm bumping into tons of them lately, in fact, and they don't really have any particular. They don't have any real. It's just like an experience they didn't like, and they're just trying to forget about it. They don't talk about it, and we don't reach them very well either. But I think what you're saying about these different groups doing other anti-oppression work, I absolutely agree we should put more effort into that if we can.
Yeah.
I need to eat some dinner, but I'm going to write to you, some of you guys, because I'm going to come east soon, and I would like to meet with you. So
when are you coming, Ted, or you don't know yet?
I don't. Right now, I'm tentatively planning leaving in about a month and spending 3 weeks to a month going to 5 different places, which will probably be cut down to about 3. One of the considerations I have is I have to have decent places to stay. And so, but I guess I have to be a little more, I don't think we should be this informal here about, we're just chatting now the way we would in private. But I did spend 3 weeks in Boston, maybe just a few weeks ago, and that was relatively easy because I had one place to stay and I met with, you know, 12, 15 different people talking about certain issues. And I want to do that again, but there's other places. There's somebody in Philadelphia who used to be extremely active, and I want to convince him to be active again. He has a lot to give. And I think you two guys in New York, I really want to talk with you. And there's people in Montreal that want to talk to me, and I want to talk to them. And apparently there's still a few people in Vermont, and, of course, there are people in Boston. So that's my plan here, 5 places in a month, but if I survive, maybe I'll get something done. It's pretty hard. I did it 40 years ago, and I was only half the age I am now, or a little less than half the age I am now. And, oh, man, it wasn't easy then. It's not going to be easy now. I don't think I can sleep on people's living room floors anymore, you know.
How are you going to sleep in a jail cell?
I don't want to sleep in a jail cell either.
Well, I said I'd give you a bed here in New York. I have a 9-bedroom house. You can come here.
What? Kevin, where are you from?
I live in Queens, New York.
Oh, great. Oh, I'm thinking you're... I don't know where I'm thinking.
You got
all right, great.
Room,
I'm
Kevin?
In New York, too.
You got
well, then we should at least meet up for coffee, and Ted can come here anytime he needs.
Well, I'll need a place to just stay while I'm in New York. Well, well this is not the
I'll
way
give
to
you
organize
a
it.
I think I think that there's plenty of obvious connections that we should be making, and I will make sure that I connect all of you folks together and so that we can continue. And others who may be interested in participating, I think that this is a really fabulous, lively discussion, and I'd like to thank everybody for calling in and talking about what's on your mind. I'm just wondering if anybody has any other things to talk about that they're thinking about or that they'd like to. I have just a couple of wrap-ups that I want to say at the end, but if anybody has any thoughts about any of this?
Yeah, I have wrap-ups. I think we don't know the answer. I don't think anyone does. And I think we did a great job discussing it tonight. And I'm glad I had the discussion.
That's fabulous. I'm glad you were part of it. George, any final thoughts, George?
Just wondering when you'll be doing this again.
I will be setting up the show, Lauren. Thanks. I'm excited about it. I have capacity for 2 hours a day, so I'm not exactly sure. I might do some in the middle. I might do some in the middle of the night, some during the middle of the day, some on Friday nights. I might do just 15-minute break-ins throughout time. And then if anybody wants, anybody who's listening or any of you who have joined me tonight want to come on for a special, you know, zoned-in specific topic to discuss something or, you know, bring in callers to talk about something specific that you're thinking about, let me know and we can set that up. I believe we can also pre-record them and play them afterwards. And so if there's some kind of actual, investigative reporting or something that people want to see done, I have my Before It's News press pass now. And so I will be working on stories as well as having these open line kinds of chats. Yeah, I'm real excited about it.
That's great. I'm excited about it too, Lauren. You're always exciting me with your PhD and stuff. It's great.
Yeah. Well, now it's next. Now what's next? Because I think we all do what we're doing, and we learn every day in different ways about how to do it better and where the connections are and what the issues are. And I think for people who are listening in the United States or anywhere in the world who want to voice something about what's happening to them individually or about us as a people, or who have events coming up that want to, be able to get some airtime about that, to get in touch with me. I want to just give an update that the conference, the Creative Revolution Conference, Developing and Expanding Alternatives, is going to be July 24th through the July 27th, 2014, in Connecticut. You can find information about the Mind Freedom International Conference in Connecticut at their website, which is www.mindfreedom.org. Sue Wittenberg, who called earlier with the International Committee to Ban Electroshock, can be reached through Sue on facebook.com/SueClarkWittenberg. The Alliance's 34th Annual Bastille Days Vigil Celebration will be July 13th starting at 6 p.m. to July 16th at 6 p.m. in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health. We do this for 72 hours because they can hold us for 72 hours and isolate us and and force us into being drugged and decide whether or not they're going to keep us for 72 hours. And everyone is at risk, and we really need to celebrate the human spirit and help break the silence of psychiatric oppression. On June 19th, 2014, we will be holding a vigil in remembrance of Esmond Green, who was murdered by neglect at Kings County Hospital Center Psychiatric Emergency Room in Brooklyn, New York. It's going to be the sixth annual vigil to remember Ms. Green. Every day people are dying. People need to understand this. Again, yesterday I had an anonymous phone call about another death at an institution at the Nathan Klein Institute on the CREF unit.
Oh, my God.
At Rockland Psychiatric Center, state-operated facility.
Oh, my God.
I have filed a death incident. I reported that it was reported to me, and I made all kinds of follow-up calls today. But this is just, you know, one person who happens, you know, that we happen to know about. And so, you know, I'm publicly putting out calls with others who are supporting this that we need the death numbers released, how many people are dying in institutions. In the 1850s, they released them with the reasons for the deaths, and I don't see why in 2014 with our technology we can't do that if they were able to manage that in the 1850s. And people need to be aware that this is happening. And then on May 31st, I will be presenting with Seth Farber and others at the Left Forum 2014 at John Jay College, John Jay Criminal College Law, CUNY, Anti-Psychiatry's Challenge to the Left, Saz, Lang, and the MAD Movement. And there's information on my website about that. And so there are lots of ways for people to get involved. If you'd like to be involved with planning for Bastille Day, please contact me or George, and the Alliance's phone number is 800-654-7227. Anybody else like to say anything?
I do.
Kevin?
Yes. Check out my foundation. It's FFUNNY, which is Foundation for Underrepresented Neighborhoods in New York, .org. So, funny.org. It's very, very cheesy. I am the president of that company, and I would like you to look at it.
Wait, tell me the name of it again. I'm sorry, I'm a little tired. What is it?
Well, that's unacceptable. I'm not going to tell you again.
It's FFUNNY.
Oh, shut up.
Org.
I was going to tell him again. FFUNNY.org. So
okay,
funny with two F's .org. And I'm the white guy. And the beautiful woman, you're going to see a hand over my shoulder. It's beautiful, Wendy Davis. And
yeah.
I would like you to check it out.
Wendy Davis?
Yeah, she's a gubernatorial candidate in Texas.
Oh, yeah, that's what I thought. What's her does she have some connection with this?
I went to a fundraiser with her and we met.
Does she have any concern about our issues?
She doesn't, but she will. And I'm trying to work on
open,
that.
Is she open to that? Because she could be very powerful. Whether she wins the Texas governorship or not, she's a rising star in the Democratic Party.
You
right
know, the
now.
Goddamn thing was, we had all these conversations. And I work with a lot of politicians, and we didn't talk about my connections.
Well, she's busy running for governor.
All right.
Okay.
Well, I will make sure, Kevin, that you are hooked up with Ted and Celia and George, and
well, I know
anybody
George.
Else.
Check
out
George's
on Facebook. FFUNNY.org. For more information there. Celia, do you have any closing thoughts?
Well, I think this is great, Lauren. Thank you. I just think we need to keep talking. I think we're isolated, and we need to have more conversations about these issues, you know? I mean, we're on Facebook, you know, but I just think we need to connect more.
We need a conference.
I think this was a great thing, and I think it was great for Lauren. And
thank you.
Everyone needs to talk more and disseminate the information. Absolutely wonderful tonight.
Absolutely. So if you'd like to be on Talk with Tenny, contact me at www.facebook.com/TennyLauren, and I will be in touch. Thank you all so much. George, Ted, any final ideas?
I think I've said my piece. I'm very excited you're doing this, Lauren. Everything you do is exciting. I really think so. I'm so glad of your leadership in this movement. I really think real highly of your leadership, and everybody else's too. I mean, Sheila, you've been going for a long time, and George, you've been going forever. I mean, this is, what did you say, it's the 34th anniversary of the Bastille Day? Well, I'm going to do my best to be there because I am coming east, and if I can help in any way to organize it, I will. I'll make sure to fit it into my schedule. I definitely want to be there, and I definitely want to help with it if I can.
All right.
That's great. George?
I'm good. Wow, Lauren, you sounded like a regular radio talk show hostess.
Good career, George. She's going to be an NBC main, you know, newscaster in another few years. Dr. Lauren Tenney speaks.
Amazing.
Yep.
Amazing.
That's so amazing.
Amazing.
Just good.
I'm very excited, and thank you all for participating in this inaugural event. And we will move forward. I will be announcing when the next show is. But anybody who's listening, you should anticipate that at various points throughout the day and night, Talk with Tenney will be on.
Not too much in the middle of the night. We have to get some sleep, Lauren.
Well, but I like it in the evening. Thank you, Lauren. Okay.
Absolutely. Everybody enjoy. We have 3 minutes. There's somebody there. 718 number.
Yes.
Hi. Who is this?
It's Christine.
Hi, Christine. How you doing?
All right. I'm listening to you on Facebook, and oh gosh, well, let me turn this off and talk to you on the phone.
Okay, we've got like 3 minutes left before the show is going to cut off.
I know.
So I just want to talk
about my father. He had a lot of electroshock treatment.
What's that?
Hello? My father had a lot of electroshock treatment. My father. Jean Boyer.
Your father did.
Yes. So much that he lost most of his memory.
I'm sorry to hear that.
But, you know, he got it back because he had a loving family, and my grandmother actually had Alzheimer's, so.
I'm really sorry to hear that. I've got somebody online.
You have my vote for whatever you're trying to do.
Thank you, Christine, and I hope that we can be in touch longer. Thank you for sharing that.
All right, well,
and
you know, we'll keep in touch by email and by Facebook, okay?
Yes, please do. Area code 250, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Good night.
Good night. Thanks, Christine.
I'm not quite sure why I'm here, but I'm here.
Okay, who is this?
It's Jerry McVeigh, and I'm calling from Canada, and I'd like to be involved in this.
Hi, Jerry. How about you give me, we're connected on Facebook, right?
Okay, so how do we do it on Facebook? A message on Facebook?
Yeah, message me on Facebook and I'll get you on the next show. Christine, you too, if you're still listening, okay? Because we're just cutting out here. We've got 30 seconds left. I want to thank you all so much for participating.
Okay, I'll get a message on Facebook.
Great. Thanks, Jerry. I want to thank you all so much for participating and listening, and I hope in the future you two will want to talk out. This is Talk with Tenny signing off for the night.
Good night.
Good night.